WACFM, and today we'll take an hour to look through the pages of a gardener's journal. Actually, the journals of three gardeners. Now, these are not actual, literal gardeners. I just felt a heart clutch in the studio here. I haven't asked anyone to bring anything in. But we want to take a look through the pages of three minds relative to gardens. And then, if you'd like to call in, through the pages of your mind relative to your garden. In the studio with me, John Leipzig. John is a professor of communications here at UAF. He began his Alaskan gardening career about 9 years ago, but it all really began, he says, at his grandfather's knee when he was about four. John has since then tested and expanded on his growing expertise in about five states and did that all before bringing it here to Fairbanks. Grant Matejke and Pat Wagner also join us today. They are agricultural assistants at UAF's Agricultural and Forestry Experimental Station. What is that? Well, we think of it as the experimental farm. Through the hour, we'll take a look at our gardens and yours. Join us. The number to call if you'd like to join us by phone is 474-5044, 474-5044. I got involved with gardening out on Chena Ridge about 12 years ago now, where there was this patch of land surrounded by killing spruce forest. And we opened it up and hauled in dirt and hauled in water and gave it a go. And I found out, boy, I was lousy at this stuff. It was just astounding. But in the last 12 years or so, it's become a lot of fun, always a challenge. I know a little bit about John's background, but I really don't know how you two got involved in gardening. Pat, did you come in through the profession or through the joy of dirt?
Well, both, I guess. When I came up to Alaska, I was involved in marine science. But the summers here were so beautiful and so short that I really didn't want to be out in the Bering Sea during the summertime. And so I was hooked. The first year I gardened was extremely successful and strictly beginner's luck. And so that got me hooked. And after that, it wasn't quite the same. But yeah. That was how I got interested.
So the dirt took you to the experimental farm, sort of.
Right.
Yeah. Grant, which way?
I came sort of in the same path. I was in marine science for a long time as a grad student, and I just always enjoyed gardening and growing things. Did quite a bit at home, liked to grow flowers a lot. When funding started to get tight in marine science, a job opened up down at the farm, and it was an ideal choice for me. I just went from solid state sediment chemistry from a little more liquid sediment chemistry.
And he's been rolling in the loam ever since.
Yeah.
Literally.
My kids always come in to work at times and see Pat and I, and they say, "You guys both have the same job. How come you're so dirty and Pat's so clean?"
We'll ask that later on in the hour. This is Conversations. You're listening to KUAC-FM today. If you'd like to join us on the phone, the number to call, 474-5044. How'd you get into your garden? John Leipzig, start us off with a look, and then the other two of you can kind of filter in as you like. There are different conditions all over the world for gardening. People have an abundance of moisture, an abundance of sun, an abundance of slugs and pests, and every place is a little different. What, for you, makes the Tananaw Valley a challenging place to grow?
Well, one of the things, obviously, is our short season, I mean, that we have to deal with really special varietals. I think that's the thing I learned really quickly here, that you can't just go out and buy a bean packet and say, oh, I'm going to throw those in the ground and expect them to do well. I mean, you have to be very, very clear on which varietals you're picking up. And the other thing you start to learn is everybody's patch of dirt's a little different up here, that you start to deal with microclimates and all this sort of thing. And so when we picked our patch of dirt, if you wish, and started to terraform it, as we say, we picked a place that obviously had a fairly good southeast kind of exposure, a good little slope for the, and also high. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're up at about 1,300 feet or a little more than that, and that helps for some things, it hinders other things. But so now we've begun our lifelong project of doing this terraforming of all that land, and we're about 6 years into the new house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's probably what drew me to it. And then every time something's new, you get done with one patch, and after you spend half your life maintaining that, you say, well, why not try this patch? So so now we're moving into things like we moved from veggies where we started into a fairly extensive rock garden with herbs and so on. We moved from there to perennial flowers, and now we're going to move to a water garden next time with a waterfall. We just ordered that, and that starts this fall. So.
You ordered a waterfall?
Actually, yeah, the whole bed. That's right. Yeah, and it's coming, and it's a rubberized kind of process that you sink into the ground about 6 by 8 by 18 inches deep. Yeah. And lily pads, whole bit. And
fascinating.
Yeah, so that's the next project.
You give the moose something to graze on besides your potatoes.
That is a problem, and the retrievers all around town are looking somewhat anxious.
We'll talk about moose and other pests as we go along in this hour. My garden's downtown. It's right where the soil is, as far as I'm concerned, the most sandy and the most rocky. And soils are peculiarities in the Tanana Valley.
Sand can be real good for some things.
Yeah, yeah. I brought in a lot of peat and topsoil mix to help rich it up, but sand is also helpful. Talk to us about soils in the Tanana Valley. They change a lot, too, from place to place.
Particularly in the lowlands and the riverbed, I think it's real sandy. Mm-hmm. And once you get up on the ridges, it's real thin. Mm-hmm. It's funny, the tourists that come through, they look at our soil where everybody's been walking and it's all compacted, and they say, this stuff looks like concrete. How can you grow anything? But actually, if you can get a little bit of organic in and fertilize, mm-hmm. it's quite adequate for growing.
Grant, soil, dirt. Tell us about dirt from your perspective.
Well, Pat's covered it. When you mentioned the river bottoms and bringing in peat and things like that, you're essentially making an ideal soil when you do that, because you're doing what a lot of people do to grow things in pots, which is the most difficult way to grow things. I find that our soils are pretty workable. I think the only problem you have with some of the silt loams that are pretty common around here is you don't want to start working them too early when they're wet. Because when you do, you just get an awful mess, and they do contract quite a bit, not mm-hmm. as much as clays, but if they're wet when you work them and then they start contracting, they'll pull apart. One year we had to put strawberries in just because the pressure of time was getting to us, and that was a real wet spring and a late season. And we tilled one that was too wet, put the strawberries in, and whole rows of them just died, because as the ground dried, they just pulled away from the roots of the plants, and the plants were sort of sitting in big cracks with nothing there. So I think that's the biggest caution that I would have. When you water, you do want to soak the ground pretty well. You don't want to just give it a little sprinkling. And also realize that when it rains here, you're really not getting any water. All you have to do is go out and scrape the first eighth of an inch of ground, and it'll be dead bone dry underneath it most times, because it was cloudy all last week. I ran a harrow over the top of some ground that looked wet, and within a half inch is just powder dry. So that's one thing that is also unique here, and it's one of the things that a lot of home gardeners have to deal with, because a lot of us, including myself, don't have wells, so we do all kinds of things. I catch water off my roof and drop it into a 1,500-gallon cistern, and usually I'm real careful with water. I do a lot of spot watering, use drip irrigation and spitters and things like that that are readily available. So these are other kind of unique things, because this is really an arid environment here.
Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, what I told folks this year, that the one real key to a good garden was a lot of water this year, because it was extremely dry. And in fact, I started very much like Grant. Well, no one had a well in my particular area, and I got so tired of carrying 7-gallon, 5-gallon jugs up that I drilled a well. And so I'm having a ball. I use little sprinklers, and I still rewarm the water and everything, but I don't have any problem at all with water, but that's unique to me up in that area.
And that's another thing that's real variable by location. Some places have had 3 or 4 downpours with, inches or more of water this year, and some of the ridge tops haven't had a thing.
Right, it's been real dry up on our ridge. And the same thing with soils. Going back to soils for a second, you start to realize, too, as you deal with plants, different plants need different soils. So it gets even more difficult if you want to deal with some of our native perennials. You really don't want to put them in a real rich soil, because they're not used to a real rich soil. They don't really like it all that well. So you start to deal with those kind of different kind of soils all the time.
And pH is another thing.
Very much.
Yeah.
It seems to be somewhat acidic here, given what we have, and so you've got to adjust sometimes with the pHs. And your nutrients in the soils aren't real good, as Grant was saying, with need of the fertilizer. I always spend that $5 for each patch of my ground that's a little different and go to the cooperative extension in the fall and say, all right, what does this need and what's it like? And I did some real raw ground, that the one we're going to do the water garden in. And they said, well, you know, you've got a little bit of nitrogen in here and you don't have anything else. So it helps.
Yeah, helps to check it out and begin to know what some of those things are. What does that mean, nitrogen, potassium?
Yeah, right.
This is Conversations, and today we're stepping into the pages of a gardener's journal, three gardener's journals. I'm Susan McInnes, your host. If you'd like to join in at any point, call 474-5044. You know, going back to the basics, there's another misleading event in Fairbanks summers. Not only when it rains do we not always get wet where we need to get wet, but we have 20 plus hours worth of sunshine, but that sunshine's not direct. It's filtered, and that has its impact on our gardens, yes? Does anybody want to tell me how that happens? What happens? Why it's a little misleading?
I'll start. hope I get some help. One of the things we looked at last year was a new type of mulch. It was developed at the University of New Hampshire in cooperation with a plastic company. And what it was designed to do was to raise soil temperatures almost as much as clear plastic mulch does, which is the best mulch for raising soil temperatures. But it cuts out enough of the light used for photosynthesis so that the weeds can't really survive underneath it. So with clear mulch that a lot of people use for strawberries or sweet corn or something like that, you have a weed problem underneath it. If it's a small plot, usually you're reaching around under that wet, muddy plastic trying to pull weeds out, and it's a real pain if you've ever done it. I have. I don't like it much. This other mulch, when we asked to test it, they were very interested in having us do it because the theory of it heating the soil up a lot, they figured, might be a little different with our conditions where the sun angle is fairly low. So the sun's coming in and we're getting a lot of sunlight, and for plants that's not too much of a problem because they tend to orient their leaves, so they're doing a real good job of catching the sunlight. But the soil can't tilt itself up to catch the sun, and that's why south-facing slopes are nice things to have here because of our low sun angle, and why north slopes are real challenges.
Mm-hmm. And why raised beds are a good idea and mulching is a good idea, both. You should take care of the feet,
The mulching, but you need to be careful between mulching to prevent weeds, which can mean dump a lot of straw on, or mulching to heat the soil, which means using clear plastic or this other plastic, because the mulching to prevent weeds in some instances actually insulates the soil and you get cooler soil temperatures, which is fine for some crops but not so good for others.
Yeah, the other problem you have with the sun, of course, is that it all comes in one burst. And a lot of plants tend to like to go through different cycles, and that's why sometimes you'll get biennial plants that will shoot their flower stalks up in 1 year, and you found this with your spinach, I'm sure, that if you grow it too early, it tends to have a problem. So some people will grow it later, will shade them. And I finally found out I really want to grow some hollyhocks, and while some of them are fairly hardy, they don't seem to ever bloom. Why? Because they need dark. So some people go around and put bags around them.
That's what I need to do with my hollyhocks. Right. I have these wonderful green, vibrant leaves and these great little buds just up their excited little knuckles.
And they won't bloom.
Nothing's happening.
You need to put a little bag.
Paper bags.
The variety that we have blooms.
It may be a varietal-specific situation, yeah.
It's not a tall one, and I doubt very much that it's perennial, but it does bloom in the summer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the other thing, particularly in the cucurbit family, which is all the squash. There's some interesting, there are a lot of things going on there, but one of the things is the light period and when female flowers, which are the ones that produce fruit, when they start coming on, because there's usually different male and female flowers. And so that's why some of the pumpkins, for instance, there might be ones that say that they're 120-day maturity and they'll make pumpkins here, whereas something that says it's a 90-day maturity, like a butternut squash,
may not.
You'll never get it.
Lovely green leaves.
Yeah. Well, and little fruits, but they won't ripen.
The choke cherry syndrome.
We find that it becomes real problematic with trees, too. So, for example, I've been real interested in trying to develop sets of apple and pear and trees like that that'll make it up here, and sometimes we're successful, sometimes not. But they really are photosensitive as to when to harden off. That they're looking for the light pattern rather than the temperature to say, okay, it's time to start converting into sugars here and drop these leaves. And so a lot of times, you know, you get first snow and all of a sudden, eek!
Wait a minute.
I'm not ready.
I'm still green.
I've got so much to do. It's kind of like us.
If these things grew up in places to the south, I could say New Jersey because I'm from there. They grew up in New Jersey and they're not ready for it to be cold until the days are pretty short. So it's a real surprise to some things that we import into here. And Don Dinko, who was the horticulturist here a number of years ago, used to always say, you can often tell whether something's going to survive if it's carrying its leaves at the end of the season when it's snowed here. If it hasn't gone through the vernalization process, getting ready for dormancy and dropped its leaves, then it may be a candidate for the dustbin next
year.
Early
death. Yeah.
And then you get the reverse in the spring, because what happens is, because you get all this burst of sun, and the little roots aren't quite ready to start working yet, and so everything starts working up top, nothing's working down below.
Yeah.
So really, that we get a thing called sun scald, that the trees literally just explode and kills them that way. So if you don't lose them in the fall, you lose them in the spring.
That's a good way to test.
Right.
We've got a couple of very patient callers on the line. Caller, can you hear me? Can I hear you? I can't hear you. Roger, we've got somebody on 5044 and I can't hear them. I'm going to put you on hold and try 5055. We'll see what we can do about this. Hello, 5045. Are you on the line?
Yes.
Good. Talk to us. You're talking to John Leipzig, Grant Matejke, and Pat Wagner.
Hi.
Hi.
I haven't had too much luck with gardens up here. And my question was this. I have spruce needles falling on part of my garden. Are they harmful to the soil?
The short answer?
They probably are fairly acidic, or they do something. There aren't too many plants that grow under a spruce tree with a heavy load of needles, so I doubt that for the flowers and vegetables that you might want to grow that they're helpful.
Is there anything I could put on the garden to counteract it other than chopping the spruce tree down?
Grant, we're taking.
Take a soil sample in and have them look at it. But another thing that's going on here that people don't often realize is that most trees can outcompete most of our vegetables and things like that we grow for water. So that if you're planting close to a tree, that root system is going to take the water before the...
And the nutrients.
Yeah, and the nutrients before your plants get them. So it's a real difficult thing to do. And after a while, if you're in a competition between your garden and the trees, and you love your garden, the trees start moving further and further back in your patch as they have in my house, because you can't be too close to them. Their roots go a long distance because they have to go a long distance to get our little water that's available, and they're real efficient at getting it.
So roots that snake out 10 feet, 25 feet in search of water aren't at all unusual, right? And they suck up nutrients and water as they go?
Not at all.
More if you chop down an aspen in your yard, you'll get water sprouts coming up from the roots, and you can trace how far they go. And I haven't exactly measured in my yard, but it's a long distance.
And point of fact, the root system gets to the point that it'll also throw in toxins from the birds. So, on top of having the acidic problem with the spruce, you get some kind of toxin that'll try to help outcompete the other plants. So, it's problematic.
Another thought or question, caller?
I said the toxin is from what?
From the birch.
From the birch.
Yeah, the birches and maples have a way of trying to kill out anything that's around them, on top of having a very porous root system that really draws down the water. So the combination for a lot of plants is real deadly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. I'm going to try 5044 again to see if someone's there. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thanks for your patience. If someone else would like to call us at 474-5044, we'll be here. Your thoughts or questions?
Well, my question is, I've at the point where I've battled the water, I've battled the chickweed, I now have a great-looking garden, and at 3 o'clock this morning, two moose are standing at the edge of my garden. And my dog is barking, and I planted my little lawn chair out there, and I sat out there for an hour. But I don't see myself being able to do that from now until September to keep my cabbage and broccoli safe. So do you have any ideas?
Yeah, good gardeners don't need sleep. Who's got a thought here? John, I know you've built moose walls, right?
I've tried it all. I started with mothballs, and that worked for a while until it rained. I tried the radio out in the garden, and they would sit down by it. I tried blood meal, which worked a little bit for a while. Then I went and did the dead bear routine, where I went out to a fishing game, and they give you half a bear hide, you got to slice it all up and hang it all around because it's supposed to be a present. They slept underneath that one.
That's aesthetic.
They're still there. It's a conversation piece. but finally, we went out. We built a corral, literally an 8-foot-high fence that they can't seem to get over. They walk around it. They kind of whine. They try to put their heads in. It's somewhat aesthetically pleasing because it is a corral type of thing. That's what it's taken. Other people have used these New Zealand electrified fences that have worked quite successful, but it really takes that, and frankly, that's what I've gone to.
Huh. It's the only thing I've heard of is a good fence, high enough that they pay attention to it.
Yeah, and pretty heavy shock on them, too, because moose have a tendency to think there's nothing they can't go through, and at the farm in the winter, they just walk right through our barbed wire fences and tear themselves up and bleed like crazy. And, you know, if
have
you ever
lunch.
See them go through, they don't even notice that there's anything in the way. Huh. They just go right through it. So the fences need to be stout and high. There's several growers that have put fences in, and they're must be 9 feet at least, and electrified fences.
The plastic pink flamingos I have in my strawberries product aren't going to do the job, right?
You never can tell what a moose will do with a pink flamingo. Yeah.
Caller, is that depressing or enlightening?
It's very depressing, mainly because at this point of the year, I'm not going to have time to build an 8-foot fence just because of my schedule and all. But when you said things like blood meal and you said mothballs, I mean, would those be a possible temporary solution? Other than sleeping out by my garden?
It's worth a try. I don't know anybody who's had any surefire luck with that sort of thing.
With blood meal, do you buy that at like a food store? Or?
I think so, right.
And then would you just sprinkle it around the outside of the garden?
Yeah, What'd you do, John?
Yeah, you put a perimeter around and make sure the perimeter stays fairly intact. The problem is blood meal is not particularly cheap. But it does add nice amendments to the soil. I mean, you get that one advantage with blood meal. But after it rains, of course, if it breaches, then they can't smell it anymore, and off they go.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
One other thing you could try is if you can find any light bird netting or some real light netting over the top of things. It tends to discourage moose, and if they're real hungry, they'll eventually go through it. But people have used it like over raspberries and things like that, and they just can't get in and feed very well through the stuff, and so
kind of annoys them.
Yeah, it may help.
Right.
Tough enough to withstand their teeth, I assume?
I don't think it is. I think they could chew through it if they want, but it's just that it kind of gets tangled up and it's
like
plastic.
It's like bothering a cat's whiskers. They don't care for that. Yeah. Right? So, yeah.
It's like dental floss. You know.
There may be moose walking around with yards and yards of this stuff stuck to their teeth, too.
Later we'll find out it's like those blasted plastic rings from Coke. Right? You're listening to Conversations with us here today. Grant Matejke, Pat Wagner, both from the Experimental Farm, and John Leipzig, who is our communications expert in the garden. I'm Susan McInnes. If you'd like to join us with questions or comments, how did you beat your moose, figuratively speaking? The number to call is 474-5044. You know, earlier somebody talked about making the soil fertile. I think it was you, Grant. Is there a radical division in schools of thoughts between chemical solutions to nutrient problems and natural organic composting solutions? And is one as viable as the other from anyone's perspective?
Let me try to start that one, and others will jump in. I don't think there is. Essentially, what the plant uses, whether it's an organic or inorganic fertilizer, are the same parts of the nutrients. They use the nitrogen, the phosphorus, and the potassium. The how you put it there is a matter, I think, of personal preference. One of the things that makes it easier to use inorganic fertilizers is you know exactly what you're getting, whereas if you're using a manure of some kind, it depends on how old it is, what the animal's been eating, et cetera, what's in there. And of course, there's a lot more nitrogen than anything else in most manures. So that's a problem with manures, and another problem is that often you do introduce a lot of weed seeds. But as far as what you're giving the plant, it's really the same thing. And there are a lot of things, and we have not yet done much research in this, but there are a lot of green manures that you can use growing a crop that, for instance, is a nitrogen-fixing crop that can tend to build up the nitrogen in the soil. That is used in a lot of places. We haven't worked too much with that yet.
Yeah, in fact, I guess the real difference, I use both, actually, and I think the real difference, nitrogen is nitrogen, let's face it, and so a lot of times I'll use an inorganic nitrogen to get things really going. However, the difference really, I think, is what it does to your soil structure, and indeed the manures and so on will really help with the tilth of the soil. With the inorganic, aren't going to do that. They're just going to give you the fertilizer that you need, okay? So if you combine the two, I think that's what's, and the green manures, I think, is where we're coming more and more of the buckwheats, but even more the clovers, the Dutch white. Make sure you don't get perennial clover, mind you.
Have it forever?
Yeah, you'll have it forever. Yeah. You know, so.
I think the thing about the organics is that if you're going solely with those, it's a lot more work involved. If you were just going to use manure, I can't remember what the figures are, but you have to use, tens of tons per acre as opposed to a much smaller amount per acre. Maybe only 2 or 3 tons. That's an exaggeration. And, you know, if you're working only with your own compost, there's a lot of work involved with that, and so you have to really be dedicated to it. But certainly in terms of the micronutrients that you get and the organic matter to the soil, there are those benefits. And so you kind of, if you've got to get organic in there somehow. Because we do tend to be pretty low in organic matter in our soils here.
And that, when you say tilth, John, you're talking about texture.
Right.
Is it aerated? Is
exactly.
It not
the way
clay?
It holds,
is it not
air
sand?
And water.
Yeah. Right.
All right. This is Conversations, the number to call if you want to join in. And I'll just say this throughout the hour, is 474-5044. If you don't want to call, stay at home and listen. It's not a problem. 474-5044. Part of the process of composting up here has to be the love of composting, right? Because it's not like California or South America where you probably put something out and it dissolves in a matter of days.
Right.
Who has composted in this group, and do you love it or hate it?
Well, there are different ways of, or different kinds of composting. The easiest way to compost is at the end of the season, simply tilling in all your organic matter. And by spring, except for an occasional corn cob that we might find, right, you'd never know that you had that big stuff there. So that's an easy way to get more organic in.
I compost with my lawnmower. As I weed the garden, throw the weeds onto the lawn and the pathways, which are all lawn and cropped weeds. And I throw them on there, and then I mow them. They all go into the bag, and then I mulch around things. And then when I, at the end of season, I run my lawnmower over all my plants. You know, I pull them out of the ground, throw them onto the grass, and mow them, and then I throw them on the garden. And it's, for me, it's the lazy woman's way of creating texture in my soil. Works.
Mm-hmm. It does work.
Yeah.
I guess the only one key to watch out is if you have any diseased plants, if you have any bugs down there, root maggots, whatever, you know, get rid of them.
Yeah, I don't do my tomatoes because they're...
They shouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For some, I don't know why, but I know that they're funky. They don't do well.
It's the, solacane or something like that in the stalks of the... There's something about it's toxic.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah.
I don't do rhubarbs because the lawnmower doesn't like them.
They've got oxalic acid.
That's right. That's right.
Any other tricks for composting?
You said you were just starting, John.
Yeah, I'm just starting. I actually just built my first bin yesterday. what had happened was I was feeling guilty about getting rid of some of these things, even the chickweed, although you got to get hot enough to burn those chickweed seeds, otherwise they're forever anyway. So I actually called the American Horticultural Society and said, how about a tumbler? And they actually have a guy that does composting for his life, okay? And he took the time to talk to me about it, and he said, the tumblers really aren't all that great. He said we've tested them, and they're okay. But he said, the best way to build a compost bin we found is go out and get these free pallets. And actually use that on the bottom and start it with that on the bottom, because it works like a chimney to get air underneath, and you're not sitting on the cold soil. And then what he suggested to do is just actually put pallets around the side too. But what I did is I went out and just got some 2x2 cedar and put that around and then strung some wire I had left over, some chicken wire rabbit fence actually I had left over, and put that in. So now I've got about 3 foot of compost. It's important, I understand, from the structure of how you put things in, like some rough coarse material to begin with, and then after that you start to put in your, let's see, what's next, grass or leaf. He was real adamant about that you need to mix your grass clippings with leaves, because he felt the leaves were a carbon cycle for you and the grass was nitrogen. And he said birch were wonderful. He said it's probably a nice moderate pH compared to some other leaves. He said, so at least you got that going for you with the birch. And then put the leaves in there, and then some soil and a little bit of fertilizer in there, and keep it a little wet, and and I'm putting the clear plastic over it to get it rolling, and then maybe in a couple years. So anyway, I mean, that's, it's a new experiment. I can't tell you how well it's going to work, but at least I'm starting.
We'll come back in 1992.
I will.
Actually, you could come back in a longer year, a longer time period, rather, if you wanted to use the real lazy person's way of doing it, which is what we do at the farm and actually what I do at home. And as we just, at home, I just pile it up. I do try and set up a little bit of flow through the bottom of it. Mostly by putting porous material down there. I don't have the palette, although one of these days I may pick one of those up and try that. But yeah. But then if you just give it a lot of time, it eventually breaks down, even under our climate, and then you can shovel it back into the garden. And rototillers, you know, as Pat said, tilling stuff in at the end of the year, rototillers do a real nice job. And they give you another benefit on slopes, too, is that if you're tilling, particularly corn, you leave pieces of corn stalk, roughage, et cetera, et cetera. It does help keep down the erosion. It just gives you something solid in there to back dirt up against. And so it's sort of an added benefit. And having that stuff in the ground, even if it doesn't break down completely over a year, is not really a problem unless it's aesthetically bothersome to you. And then you can till again and rake it up.
Do you have a composting tip, our listeners out in the KUAC audience, or a composting failure? Now, tips and failures are both reliable here on this program. We're both acceptable here. The number to call is 474-5044. If, with your permission, I'd like to move on to pests, small ones, not moose, but the smaller ones. A couple years ago, I had, fairly early in the season, the sad discovery that my delphinium leaves were just wrapping around themselves. And when I unfolded them, it's a little green worm who was so happy and so healthy and just munching. And what happened with the delphinium is, instead of giving me a good, strong lower bush and great spikes coming out, is it just wilted. It was just terrible things. And when I called, they said, well, you can murder them, but you take a chance of murdering your plant, or you can pick them off and crunch them and throw them away. What was I dealing with? Does anyone know? And is the right thing to pick them off and throw them away?
I think that's actually the name of it.
A delphinium defoliator?
That's what it is.
It's great. No, it wasn't great.
No, it wasn't. I've had it happen too. So it's a matter of either you go around, like you say, and basically skewer each worm, and they're pretty fast, or try to, early in the season, use some type of chemical control for it. Diazon, something like that, does work.
The biological one, the Bacillus thuringiensis, that's supposed to be for all Lepidoptera, all caterpillar types, but because it goes in the gut and destroys them that way, it's not an immediate kill, so I don't know how fast it acts, actually.
You need patience.
The organics are going to be less disruptive than the chemicals if you overdo. That's always the problem with the plant to cure the problem.
Yeah, no, the biological type things are always less destructive. Yeah. Well, as far as I know.
The other tip is don't overdo. Even with nutrients, although not so much nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, but if you're adding micronutrients, there's a real narrow range, and at very low levels, they can become toxic to the plants. And the same thing with chemicals which are designed to kill things. I mean, I can see no reason why anyone would not apply at the recommended rate, and they're very specific.
People think more is better.
Right. But more is not better.
No.
and it won't kill them any deader by putting more things in there, you're running the chance of damaging your plants and getting stuff into the soil and then into the water and things like that. Right. So it's really important to read all the directions, the precautions for you and for the plants.
So be careful with both your weapons and your fertilizers as you're going along.
Read the label, as they say in the trade, and then read it again.
The thing about the biologicals is that they're usually pretty specific. Mm-hmm. Like this certain bacteria only acts on insects of the one order. And so, not that I'm saying you should ever overdo it, but it gives you a little more room for confidence.
And it's like the safer soaps and so on that have come out now, which I've gone to almost exclusively. I mean, it's basically it disrupts their ability then to continue to breathe, to respire. So it kills them, but you've got to go out and do it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can go out there with melatonin and just... but you feel somehow somewhat better doing that.
The other thing is, too, is if you are... using any kind of live biological control, then you need to use the most gentle kinds of pesticides when you have to knock down a real high population or you have some other pest that's coming in and bothering it, because you'll kill all those beneficials that are in there. And we have some beneficials, you know, that are just naturally here. There's a fair number of ladybugs around who do a good job of eating the
aphids. Things like birds are good insect controllers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is KUAC's Conversations. Today, we're talking about gardens. If you'd like to join in, you can call us at 474-5044. Caller, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for your patience. Come on ahead.
Well, my name is Suzanne, and I've just moved here from Tacoma, Washington, and I've been composting for years there, and it's very, very interesting. Because we have so much rain, I suppose things break down, you know, rather rapidly, but in the winter, it's so itchy to get outside. What I've done for years is take my compost, my clippings from my kitchen, and put it in a blender. It sounds kind of itchy, but just once a week, put it in a blender, and I just go outside and pour that stuff right along the rows in my garden, and
great
do it all winter long, all winter. And in the summer, it's just kind of all gone, and I've had beautiful gardens.
Suzanne, what a great idea, Cuisinart composting. That's wonderful. Thanks. I'll get started when I get home. Any other thoughts or questions?
No, that's all. Thank you.
All right. Keep gardening.
The only thing about up here is usually you'd be pouring it in the snow somewhere instead of...
That's right.
A big vat in the basement.
We have another caller on the line. Hi. If you'd like to call, call us at 474-5044. Sorry for interrupting. Hi there.
Hi. I have a question about asparagus. I planted some asparagus plants about 3 years ago, and I've just sort of let them grow as they will. I haven't done anything with them, and I keep thinking I ought to. Does anybody know what I should be doing? Have any suggestions?
Well, a couple of us have tried that, right, Grant? asparagus up here seems to not like to spread like it does in the lower 48. It tends to kind of clump. I'm just in year two now of a new variety of the Jersey hybrids that are supposed to be all males, but it turns out the ones I got are not all males, which I noted with the little flowers. I said, wait a minute. Nonetheless, you should occasionally thin out a few of the stalks if they've been there that long. You can. It's probably a little late now, but make sure you've got a lot of good fern on them to help your root structure later.
Okay.
Other thoughts on asparagus, Pat?
Have you been harvesting them?
No, I haven't yet. They've been very, very thin so far.
That's one of the problems here, too. That depends on the varietal. A lot of times you'll get littler than pencil stalks. And a lot of the varieties never get much bigger than that, do they?
Are they edible at pencil stage?
Oh, yes.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're
so you
delicious.
Can...
Oh, so next year I can harvest, right?
Yeah, there's a fairly narrow window for harvesting because you need to allow them... I would say, what? As soon as they start coming up until maybe the middle of June is probably...
Yeah.
You shouldn't harvest any later than that because they do need to grow the ferns in order to make enough energy to put down in those roots to make it through the winter.
Okay.
But I'd go ahead and start harvesting anything that's big enough, but remember to cut it off early enough to let them grow.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your question. If you've got a question or an answer, call us at 474-5044. The topic is gardening. I have one more pest question.
Okay.
Right. I know about the chickweed. Pull it out. Don't let it get a hold or you'll have a beautiful chickweed garden, right? Or mulch it or something. I have aphid questions. I have raspberries that for the last several years have had an annual attack by the aphid of the species. The first year, I just wept along with the raspberries. The second year, I decided that we were going for chemical overkill, and the raspberries got mad at me and didn't do a thing for a couple of years. Now I've got aphids this year. I had the relative of a friend come in town who said, well, you smoke cigarettes, just put all your cigarette butts in a can, fill it with water, and get the nicotine and whatever else, and use a light solution and spray them, and then wait a while and wash it off. And then I listened to a program on gardening that said, well, actually what you're supposed to use is dish soap, and not Tide or clothing soap, but dish soap on a 2% solution, do the same thing, spray it in, get incredible thumb muscles doing that, and then wait a couple hours and wash it off. Are these good plans? Am I dealing with good old wives' tales or just old wives? What's the question?
Nicotine's definitely deadly to aphids, and in the green, it's a restricted pesticide, nicotine sulfate. You can buy it in smoke form, but you need a license to get it, and we use it in the greenhouse with pretty good success. If you could wash your raspberries, then it might be a possibility. I know people do use that on vegetables in their garden, but the fact that raspberries are so hard to wash, I'm not sure I'd want to put nicotine on my raspberries that I'm going to eat. The soap, they're saying it's like an insecticidal soap, like Safer's or something.
No, she said she gave a couple of brands, like Dove and Palmolive.
Right, but it's the same.
Oh.
The same thing. They react on the exoskeleton of the animal, and I wouldn't to save your finger muscles. I'd invest in a little pump-up sprayer or something.
Yeah, let me expand on that, because I think that's the real key. Because with all of these soaps, you have to have contact with the bug to kill it. And so if you get a pump-up sprayer and then can really bring it up to high pressure, then you get lots of that stuff in there.
It's
good
definitely
coverage.
A contact killer.
So if you're there with a hand spray bottle, particularly with raspberries, which tend to put out a lot of foliage, you're not going to hit enough of the aphids to help. But if you get your sprayer pumped up enough so that when you spray in there, it's actually lifting the leaves back a little bit and getting coverage all over the place with real fine droplets, then you can do it. So that's what I'd do. I'd invest in a pump-up sprayer, and I'd really pump it up. If you get one with a gauge on it, 70 pounds is not too high.
Whoop those things. Send them flying. Drown them. The number to call is 474-5044. We're talking with gardeners today about gardening.
The other question I have is your raspberry patch under the birch trees?
No, it's under my choke cherries.
Under your choke?
They'll get
coming
some aphids,
off the,
too.
Yeah. The birch are particularly bad for aphids, and if you can stay away from your birch trees, sometimes that helps.
I won't plant any.
The other pest we haven't talked about is the vole.
I'm in town. We have fewer. The vole.
Yeah, the vole. They have a way of loving to go right underneath the snow line and girdle
lilies.
Every little tree, or the lilies. Uh-huh. Or during the year, they may even burrow down and get your carrots. And
potatoes.
Potatoes. And so it's really worth your while to invest in a cat.
The one sure cure, the toxin.
Yes. I was at a garage sale yesterday where someone was selling ferrets, and they were saying that they have no problems with voles. And then another suggestion we once had from someone in Fish and Game was that we put up a lot of loose rock walls, because that's good habitat for leased weasels. And leased weasels, of course, are excellent vole killers, because they can go right down in the holes after them. And so they have advantages over cats and dogs.
Now, is this anywhere close to the Australian solution? I can't remember what species they brought in to whoop what species, but they had
the mongoose.
Something to brought rabbits in.
The weasels are natives.
Weasels are natives.
It's not a problem.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend letting ferrets loose. These are apparently tame ones that come home again.
And the rock walls are an advantage. We've got enough rocks around that you can build, and that's what we've done on our terrace. We've done all our terracing with rock walls, and we hope there are least weasels there, but we still have a population of voles. It took out a lot of my cherries this year.
Well, with the rock wall, at the very least, the little voles have trouble getting up the rock.
No, I don't think so.
I think they can go anywhere.
This is Conversations. The topic is gardening. The number to call, 474-5044. John Leipzig is a professor of communications here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He does his gardening by love, and has so in Alaska for about 9 years, and since he was a whippersnapper at his granddad's knee in other states. Pat Wagner is with us, came to gardening through water, as did Grant Mateke. Both of them work at the experimental farm. I'm Susan McInnes, and I'm definitely just a kid who likes to play in the dirt. Now, let me think. I wanted to talk about the joys of gardening. It seems to me it goes beyond the harvest. And, John, I know you've thought about this.
Yeah, it... It's kind of a cyclic thing, to be honest with you. You're able to see in one season the whole realm of birth, life, death, the whole process. I think that's important. It's also there's a certain aesthetic quality to be able to go out and to see things form and to change. And they're using a tremendous amount of gardening now for both therapeutic. I mean, there's a whole journal on therapeutic agriculture. They're using it for children. For example, Denali School here in town has a major, just a wonderful garden that they've developed through a cooperation with parents, a small grant. Jan Hanscom spent a lot of her time here from the university, who works mm-hmm. up at the farm and so on. And the children just love to get their hands dirty, and they love to see things grow. They love to experiment with things, like they're trying to see if peeled potatoes grow. Well, you know, I mean, you can tell them, but it's much better if they can see it grow and experience it. It's really hands-on science. That's what it's about.
And the nurturing aspect, too.
Yes.
I think the fact that you are able to nurture and to grow and to see the benefits of care and
right.
Sort of have a personal relationship with the plants.
Yeah, I was amazed the first time the children named their tomatoes. They named every one of their tomatoes. And we went in, and I thought, oh, wow, sure, why not? I never named a tomato, by you. but it is that, and there's a quiet. I mean, sometimes I do a lot of my gardening from, 11 o'clock p.m. on. The kids are finally in bed, and I'm walking out there. It's just calming kind of effect I found.
Has nothing to do with work, has nothing to do with other obligations, stresses, strains. You're just out there with the weeds and the tomatoes and
Yeah, there is that garden sprint early in the spring that's more like work at times. but now you really don't associate that way most of the time. It's just the love of going out there and messing with it, seeing what you can get away with, too. That's part of the fun here.
And there's a lot of discovery. There are good discoveries and sometimes not good discoveries,
true.
But you're always finding new things, always learning.
Well, there's something, I mean... There's something of the intellect and the chemistry and of it, the joy of, as you say, fiddling with Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. But there's also just the amazement at the springtime every year. My snow is just disappearing from my yard when the rhubarb come up in bright red knuckles, just quink, right out of the earth. The earth is solid rock. I'd have to take frozen, have to take a pickaxe to it. And the rhubarb have figured out a way to split that soil open and are so excited because the sun is out and it's warmer than it was, and in a couple of days I'm going to make this amazing leaf.
Right.
And they just do that. And I suppose it's just the magic of life on this planet that mostly knocks me out.
Yeah, and you see that. You see that renewal. I mean, that's the thing. You know next year there's going to be some renewal, along with the chickweed.
Yeah. Especially important to us here after we've been through all the long winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's so exciting to see things green and growing again.
And that's part of the fun of if you can start things, most of them yourself. I mean, you really start gardening about, November, December, when all the catalogs come in and you just kind of paw over them. And every year you try a few experiments, right? And what I do basically, I don't have an actual outdoor greenhouse, but what I do is I have got an attachment that I put on the front atrium that's it's just kind of a hoop out of PVC plastic, and I put UV stabilized plastic over that and open up my atrium in April. Mm-hmm. So I start everything by lights. Down in every closet nook and cranny I can deal with, and then this PVC goes up, and we open that up, and so we have a kind of an 8x10 starting greenhouse there from there till June. Then that comes down and it goes in the garden. So I mean, mm-hmm. you're really doing it from November on. Mm-hmm. You see the green, and it's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, Grant Mataki, any of the
winter,
romance of gardening?
Winter development of green is a real nice thing. And the other thing, I think one of the things I like the most about it is the discovery and the constant challenge and newness of it. It's just that there's always some thing that'll come up that you had never anticipated. I think it's, if you're... maybe intellectually not so bright, it's a good thing to do, a good field to do science in, because the questions pop out right in front of you. You don't need to search for real esoteric things to look at and study. There's just a million things. And then the other thing about that's nice about having it as a job is it really keeps you from ever getting lazy, because you are dealing with living things. And so if you're going to go home one evening and you catch out of the corner of your eye that something's wilting out in the garden, garden or something like that, which often happens early in the spring when we've just transplanted, you know, it's zip right around. There's a responsibility to something alive there that I find is rewarding, although at times I would like to just put the foot on the pedal and keep going.
That responsiveness to the hand is also, or to the ministration, is a wonderful thing. You water me, I'll grow. You don't.
Hmm. Yeah, most plants are also amazingly adaptable and can stand a fair bit of abuse, so it's nice to see their capacity to come back from some sort of onslaught, such as 10,000 aphids all over the top of a delphinium, and you get them off of there, and the delphinium can recover, or something that's for some reason or another, somebody got sick on the weekend or something and didn't get a chance to notify someone that the greenhouse didn't get watered, or something got missed and it's just absolutely out flat on Monday, and you come in and water it, and lo and behold, the thing has a capacity to recover often. So
comes
it's
back.
Yeah, it's a...
And there's so many different levels you can take it on. I mean, you can you can go as deep as you want to go, and like John said, there's always something new to try. You know, you can go for water gardens or apples or...
What? Yeah, you can see I'm kind of on the edge with some of this stuff. I mean, it's like I brought a rhododendron home 3 years ago. Just a small one, a little creeping one. And it's been alive outside for 3 years. And I'm ecstatic, but it may be dead next year. but you can try them. I mean, you can, like I said, you've got some booklets. I know Grant brought one along with him that was put out by Cooperative Extension with the varieties. And as long as you can kind of try to keep things that are close to our zonal kind of requirements, you can you have a chance.
Yeah. I have books from Cooperative Extension tacked up on nails in the greenhouse and sitting in the bookshelves of my office, and they're just always there. That's wonderful. Eloise DeWitt, I can do this. Eloise DeWitt's book, The Beginner's Guide to Gardening in Fairbanks, is a wonderful little reference. So there are specific books for here. You're on Conversations. We have a caller. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling because I just did some landscaping work in front of my house, and it's a very shaded area, and I want to put something attractive there, and I'm thinking of some of the native ferns that I saw at a local greenhouse. Has anybody had success with those, or...?
Oh yeah,
lots of success.
Yeah, actually, not to take a thing away from our local greenhouses, but you can tootle down the Parks Highway and look to the right or the left and take your shovel with you.
I was planning on doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And most of them are very, very strong and are willing to propagate very quickly, you'll find. So, I mean,
any special care for the soil?
Actually, they like it a little acidic.
And a fair amount of organic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So occasionally, maybe a little muracid if they start to turn yellow. I find that's the only thing I use muracid for, that and the pines and so on, because it helps acidify, and the rhododendron that I talked about. And I use that just for those areas.
Can you put any flowers in with them, or because they're not going to get too much sun?
You know what's kind of nice is that little native dogwood.
Oh boy,
and
I have a lot of it around.
And
that's
it's
what
gorgeous.
I was thinking of transplanting.
It's gorgeous right along the border of your ferns, because it'll grow kind of a nice low mat, and then you get the white flower, and then you get the red berries. So it's really quite pretty, and it likes the same soil.
A little hard to transplant.
True.
What special care needs to be taken?
Well, it sends runners out all over the place, so I think if you can find one sort of compact spot to dig and then do your best there.
There's
and
a whole quarter acre up, huh?
Yeah. Well, if you can just get a little bit of it going, it'll spread itself. So.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Also, I just started a compost pile, but can I burn that and just put it on the garden in the...
If you burn, you're not going to have compost. You'll have ashes.
Will that help at all?
They're more acidic, as I remember. They're more basic. More basic, yeah. And so that you have to, and you're going to lose some of your nutrients, too, with the heat. So I think I'd probably recommend against it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. That is a thought. You know, this fellow asked questions of the experts. We have three experts in the room for another 6-7 minutes. Give us a call at 474-5044. What are you folks growing this year that you're finding especially challenging, delightful, pleasant, exciting, distressing?
One thing I've been real happy with are scarlet runner beans. Real happy with. I found a varietal out of Thompson Morgan by the name of Butler. that I had real good luck with. It just put out spectacular vines, beautiful red flowers, and wonderful beans. Mm. A lot of people look at them as flowers, but the beans are just delicious. And so I save the seed. I've started to get more and more to saving my own seed. And as long as it doesn't hybridize with something, I'm okay. So that's something that I've had real good luck with. And I grow it on a bean tower that I put up every year. And so you get this big, massive foliage and the really lovely flowers. So that's one thing that I'm going to keep.
Runner beans.
Runner beans, scarlet runners.
We have a caller leapt in. You're on the line. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, I've got a question about some pumpkins. I've got very yellow leaves on, I think they're different varieties that I've got planted out there, and they've just got some clear this green around them. And I wonder if you could tell me what I would do to help get some better color. These leaves, what that indicates.
What do you think, Grant?
It's real hard to diagnose problems unless you can see the leaves. I mean, we get calls all the time, my tomatoes look like this, that, and the other thing. And when we try and make guesses, often, you know, the symptoms aren't exactly what we're thinking of. So to analyze problems like that, you really need to look at them. One of the things that can happen with all the cucurbits is if it starts getting cool at night, often they'll yellow a little bit because they like warmer soils, although I wouldn't imagine that would have happened
yet this
year.
Are they outside or inside?
They're outside, and they're not that far from a birch tree.
It sounds like low nutrient, but and low nitrogen, but then there are a lot of, I mean, if the soil's too wet, if it's in a real low area, they won't be able to take up the nitrogen. As Grant said, when it starts getting cool, they don't take up nitrogen.
Do they prefer drier and warm?
Pardon?
They prefer drier soil?
Adequate moisture, but certainly not soggy.
Uh-huh. Okay. And another question I have is this garden, there was a spot on it where stuff had been burned. I don't know if it was organic stuff or other stuff by the previous owners. And that, now even 3 years later, is still giving a lot less to the plants that are there. Whatever is planted there seems to come up much slower and much smaller. What would burning have done to the soil if there had been a big pile of stuff that had been burned there in an area that was maybe, 8 feet in diameter? Would that have destroyed a lot of the nutrients? And
it would probably change the pH, would be my guess. And what I would do is simply take several soil samples out of that area. And when you take a soil sample, the best thing to do is make it out of 10 sort of sub-samples. So put your shovel down and take a little bit of dirt. The Extension Service has a bulletin about exactly the best way to do this. And then put all that in a bag and mix it up. And then you may want to take one from right in the center of that and another sample from right along the edge just to see whether you're getting any kind of gradation. And then once you're armed with that information, those problems can be corrected.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. We had another caller on the line who probably looked at the clock and left us. If you'd like to call back, do so on August 25th. In another month, we're going to be talking about closing down the garden. Some of these folks and some other folks may be coming in to sit down. We haven't quite got the guest list set up yet to talk about gardening around Fairbanks, shutting down the garden and getting ready for next year. So keep the number, 474-5044. Give us a call in a month here on Conversations. In the meantime, there'll be other thoughts and programs. Last thoughts about gardens? We've got 2-3 minutes left about, or the last question I asked John, what are you guys growing this year that you like best?
I want to add a little about that. Yeah, one of the things we're doing this year is we're working on a multi-year plan to essentially develop the area in the farm where we used to have what we call the demonstration garden into a botanical garden. This year we have a lot of perennials, some several years old, that are in a grassed-in area, and they're really making a nice display. So I guess the thing that we're most excited about, at least I'm most excited about this year, is having those perennials out there for people to come and see some of the new things. These are variety trials, things we've tried, and they have stakes in front of them. Finally, about a week and a half ago, we got all the labels
completely done. Completely legible computer.
The computer helped us out and got us organized a little bit, and they tell you when they were put put in, how many were put in, and you can sit there and look at the results yourself. And it's a good chance for people to come and get familiar with some of the perennials that we have. We have a fair number of native plants that we've put in there that are very nice.
Some ornamental grasses
that are just beautiful, one of which I'm going to put in a crack grass problem area where I have at home to outcompete that, and it looks like it will do it. It's a sort of variegated thing with a little white on the edge of the leaves, real pretty. So that's something that I'd like people to come out and take a look at. And
wonderful.
Just extend an invitation for people to come out and see the gardens.
Taking advantage of your experimental farm. It's just west of the university on the side road on your way out to Sheep Creek and the rest of the valley. We got probably 30 seconds. A last thought, Pat Wagner? You don't have to have one. It's all right. I thought I saw you trying to respond to Grant. So.
No, pretty much what Grant was saying.
Good.
Perennials are important. I think as you get older and older with your gardens, you go to more and more perennials.
So that's what's happening to me.
Me too, for sure.
Yep, I put them in this year and last.
It's a little ways down the road, but we're hoping to have a water garden at the farm one of these days.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. In the meantime, y'all come up and watch John.
Yeah, that's right. John will be the pioneer.
You can help
here.
Me dig.
This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I'm here every Sunday at noon on tape or live talking about various topics. And every now and then I like to have some folks in just to talk about what's happening in Fairbanks. Today, it was gardens. Pleasure to be with you. Join us next week. My thanks to Roger Left and David Searle, who's on the board and will join you in just a minute. Have a good Sunday.